world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Will they find life on Mars? Maybe they can't land just exactly at the time they wanted to, and maybe it's going to be a little late, but there are those two craft which are going to land on the surface of Mars and try to determine whether or not there is some form of life other than human life and all of the flora and fauna of this beautiful Earth somewhere out there in space. And perhaps within the next few weeks, even though the ballyhoo of the election process in the United States will dominate much of the news, you will find somewhere in the science section or back in the corner or on page 18 of some of the big city newspapers, word about the Mars-bound Viking 1 riding in the nose of our biggest interplanetary rocket, the four-stage Titan 3E, after that successful launch last year. And Viking 2, remember, followed shortly afterward. Their trajectory took them on a 505 million mile journey to Mars. You've already been seeing some of the most sensational pictures in all of the history of man's experience by seeing actual detailed photographs of various intrusions of what appear to be magma or flows of lava in cracks, all types of erosion processes which seem to be affecting the surface of this planet of Mars, the famous red planet, where as long ago as 100 years and then some, through some of the more primitive telescopes of the time, man thought they saw canals and various green belts and activity that they thought might indicate life on Mars. Now, there's quite a gigantic principle at stake here when you look at what science is able to achieve with lunar landings and with various space probes, including a soft landing on Mars and the experimental equipment I can tell you a little bit about, which is aboard. The really big thing at stake, perhaps, is the age-old issue that goes clear back, I guess, to that famous Scopes trial. It goes clear back to the question of creation versus evolution. It goes back to the simple question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is there a God? And if there is a God, is the Bible His Word? If that is true, and if there is a God and the Bible is His Word, the avowed expressed will of that great Creator being, then the Bible contains prophecies. About a third of the Bible is prophecy, which is a time series sequence of events, a planned schedule of events, which is being worked out in the entirety of the universe, but principally with its focal point on this earth. And if all of that is so, then there's no life whatsoever on Mars. But you know, the scientists might keep us guessing for a while. And here's how they might do it. For example, there are going to be some biological tests beginning about 8 days after touchdown of each of these vehicles, and will take about 12 days to complete. Now, the tests are designed to reveal whether or not there will be the presence of various microorganisms or even various other tests and experiments they're going to try to conduct, which might not necessarily detect any microorganisms, but if they are successful in detecting various gases or the like, they could begin to speculate that perhaps the same type of atmospheric conditions, such as methane and ammonia and the like, would be present, where they could begin to speculate to you in science fiction-like articles, which would appear in newspapers, that perhaps Mars is in some or another stage of evolutionary development. They could even speculate that maybe it's right on the verge of having life struck on the surface of the red planet, like they claim occurred on the surface of the Earth. Is evolution the result by which you came to be? Did you come from cracks in rocks, from polka-dotted bubbles in the sea, from a primordial swamp seething with bubbling gases of methane and ammonia? Did you come from lovesick amoeba? Was there an ageless process by which, through the billions of uncounted aeons, because you can't even deal in terms of years, this is meaningless. You've got to talk about billions of aeons, and just given enough time, the vastness of eternity, the nothingness of ever, ever land, to even begin to conceive of the idea of evolution ever coming to pass. Now, I've done, I guess, dozens of programs on it, taught college classes on it, studied it up and down, quoted some of the leading figures in evolutionary thought, taken issue with it time and time again on television series and the like with support material. Articles in our publication, the international magazine, The Plain Truth, The Magazine of Understanding, We've had a whole series of articles in past years exposing, absolutely taking the wraps off this empty, mindless theory. Now, I'm not saying that people who propose theories are not intelligent men. They are. Evolution is the product of intelligent minds. But, you know, there is such a thing as revealed knowledge, and there is such a thing as intellectual foolishness, too. Explosions in print shops, I have said, to try to make it clear to people, do not produce encyclopedias. Automobile wrecks do not produce new automobile designs. Accidents do not create symmetry, beauty, and harmony. This world and all that exists upon it, you see an absolute symmetry and harmony. You see interdependency. You see various forms of life utterly and totally dependable and dependent upon each other, which have to depend upon each other for their life source, their food, their survival, their protection. You see various camouflage and coloration. You look at all of the intricacies of nature, the cleavage properties of mineral, the way they form, the various minerals and the rocks of the earth. And you look at law, and you look at order. You look at life according to life of the preceding kind of life, that life reproduces according to the preceding or the foregoing life, the forbearing life of its own kind, and that kind begets kind and like begets like, and that this is never broken. Even though there may be hybrids, there may be various mutations which can occur, and there is an almost infinite area of variety for the development of various species that inhabit this earth. But now back to the Mars landing for a moment to tell you about the biological experiments they're going to conduct. About 8 days after touchdown in each case, even though they've had to now readjust the area where Viking 1 was going to touch down, they will begin these experiments. It'll take about 12 days to complete if everything goes right. And they're designed to reveal whether or not there is the presence of microorganisms on the surface of Mars, whether there is any form of life at all. Now, while they're already saying in various publications, it is unlikely that there are any forms of higher animals, meaning they could find lobsters, crabs, or perhaps they're even talking about various little land types animals. They're already saying that's unlikely. But they do have TV cameras, which they think that if that could be possible, they would detect such animals creeping around the surface. But the three principal life-detecting devices aboard these Viking landers are a kind of a biology experiment housed in a box not much bigger than a large suitcase, and yet one of the most sophisticated pieces of scientific equipment ever built by man, and of course hugely costly. It contains three automatic laboratories, would you believe, in this tiny little size. It contains a computer, tiny little ovens. It actually has counters to detect radioactivity. It has filters. It has a sun lamp, various other scientific experimental equipment to identify chemicals. It has up to 40 thermostats and about 22,000 transistors and 18,000 other electronic parts in it. 43 tiny microscopic miniature little valves. The biology instrument will make these chemical tests for living things in soil samples that the lander scoops up by three or four separate experiments, all of which could keep the public guessing for perhaps months, simply because of the vagueness of the way the experiments are described. For example, there is a pyrolytic release experiment which will measure photosynthesis of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide in Mars atmosphere. Now, that experiment is supposed to measure whether or not there is actual changing of compounds in a kind of an atmosphere, if such an atmosphere exists. Is there anything which could be called air? Would there even be present carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide on the surface of Mars? They don't know yet. But the potential fauna, they say, could announce itself this way. In other words, by this experiment of this releasing these gases to measure the photosynthesis that might occur by releasing gases which have been conveyed to Mars from the Earth, they could then say, well, some of the same processes which go on the surface of the Earth are also occurring on Mars. Now, there's another experiment that is called a labeled release experiment, which is supposed to test Martian creatures' ability. Now, already as you read some of these articles, you see the subtleties that are implied. Just as in some of the textbooks in some of the science classes in colleges, which begin with perhapses, possiblys, maybes, and supposes, and so on. They kind of take the reader through a long introductory chapter about perhaps long ago it happened this way. There was a gigantic explosion, and possibly one chunk of this great, huge, big atom went hurtling off into the universe, and maybe it gradually began to cool. Now, the next statement, after all those possibles, perhaps, and maybes is, as this cooling process took place, so now the language changes, and it's positive, and it's actually a process that you, as the reader, think you are witnessing down through the span of countless aeons of time, that thus and such would happen. These various gases would do this and that, and various forces would begin to act, and perhaps lightning would strike a match in a sulfuric or an ammonic soup in the sea sometime. And so gradually, from all the perhapses, maybes, supposes, and wherewithals and possiblys, you get down to thus happened, and this happened, and the other thing happened. Now, in this interesting article which I am referring to concerning the Viking landings, they do the same thing. I'll quote to you from the article right here, which source I would prefer not to reveal for the moment, but it is a very scientific type of a journal, quite a scientific article. Matter of fact, I can tell you the author is Wernher von Braun. It was published in several different publications, though, and picked up by newspapers all over the country, but Dr. Wernher von Braun is the one who wrote the article. It says this: after the release experiment in which the article says some of Mars' potential fauna could announce themselves in this way. Now, the word potential is used. Then the following statement comes right along. A labeled release experiment will test Martian creatures' ability to break down water solutions. Now, there, the possibly existing creatures is left out. There is no word which further serves to lead the reader to speculate whether or not any such creatures exist. By the time you get to the next statement, it is just assumed there are going to be creatures on Mars, and this tests their ability to break down water solutions of simple organic compounds to carbon dioxide, which would be another sign of life. And by the way, they tell you the compounds, carbon, will be labeled with radioactive C14 to trace its progress. So those experiments could keep us guessing as we read various statements about alleged presence of different gases or a photosynthesis process acting upon those gases. And for months, we could hear claims, possible life on Mars, probable life on Mars, maybe there is life on Mars. Or you could even hear that someday there will be life on Mars. And I suppose that everyone is going to be very suitably impressed. Now, is there life on Mars? No, there is not life on Mars. Is the Viking landing going to actually prove there is life on Mars? No, it is not going to prove there is life on Mars, because there is no life on Mars. Will these experiments make it appear that there might be, or that there could be, or that there are certain processes which might lead toward life on Mars? Oh, yes, they definitely will do that. It'll be a very interesting thing to watch as it occurs. Here is one interesting statement in the article, for example. Although no single test will positively confirm life by itself, a team of scientists should reach a pretty certain conclusion if all three experiments point to living microorganisms. They might decide that there is a kind of a virus. They might decide there is a certain type of a microorganism which is very primitive, and that would, of course, be a word which would be very acceptable to science to use, just as they do in the evolutionary thought that you see propounded in some of the textbooks of the colleges of the day. But no, there is no life on Mars, and you can see that proved, believe it or not, in the Bible. How the world itself was made to be inhabited, and we have already seen these lifeless, empty pictures that came back. When I first went down to NASA headquarters at Houston and was ushered through all of that, and I went down to the Kennedy Space Center, even at the time it was called Cape Canaveral, and the Gemini Thora Gina series, and then saw the various Saturn moon shots and so on, and covered some of this type of space exploration for The World Tomorrow on radio as well as television. And I saw these endless laboratories down there, fabulously expensive, and how when the first moon rocks were brought back, this unbelievably careful quarantine experiment of taking them from one chamber, almost like sticking your hands with great rubber gloves, and then there would be this diaphragm in which you would work, and it would be kind of like a huge iron lung would perhaps be the best representative to talk about the way some of these laboratories were fixed up. These rocks would be actually picked up by mechanical hands and taken in a completely sterile environment, so tremendously carefully controlled so as to not allow the escaping of any type of even one little bacteria into the Earth's atmosphere because people had all kinds of wild speculation. They'd read some of these science fiction things about the blob, I guess, about the housewife who mixes two soaps and a green blob comes out of the sink and begins to absorb the whole world. I mean, you've heard of things like that. So people actually began to expect that if there was life on the moon, of all things, it would probably be fairly primitive life, meaning microorganisms, and they thought there might be germs on the moon. And that those germs, even, you know, some people reason that germs have intelligence. And that they could attack the world and perhaps given release into the Earth's atmosphere, well, we could have who knows what science fiction type of prediction said that possibly they could explode and grow like mad and disease the whole world and we could all die in a matter of a month or so. And so an international hue and cry from all kinds of governments around the world went up demanding of the United States and of the Soviet Union in space exploration that they protect the entirety of the world. And of course, great publicity. That's why NASA wanted to show off its laboratories. A tremendous amount of publicity was given to the double fail-safe, extra security, absolutely airtight, germ-tight, you know, foolproof system of carefully quarantining the men, the dust on their clothes, the rocks, everything, when they came back from the surface of the moon. And of course, that was done. And so now today, you can see lunar rocks. A lot of times we will have various, well, in the bicentennial display, for example, here and there around the country. Some universities, right up here at JPL, above where I'm speaking to you from here in Pasadena, California. And I've seen some of these lunar rocks, moon rocks, myself. They're now in various places around the country, and no doubt hundreds of thousands or millions of Americans have actually been able to walk by and to view a piece of rock which looks not unlike something you might find in your driveway, which came from the moon. And they now know there was no life whatsoever of any kind up there. But oh, the excitement. Think of the expenditure, the international furor, the apprehension, and the fear that maybe there would be life there. Now we're going through the same thing with the Viking landings on Mars as a new search begins for life in outer space. Man desperately seems to feel the need to discover that we are the result not of creation, not of divine intent, not a part of an orderly, systematic universe in which the world is the focal point of attention with a great purpose, riding our own spaceship out in the blackness of space with a gigantic purpose and program in mind, with a definite goal, a meaning for the trip, for the journey that we're on. No, we would like to think that we came from animal life. Now, why? Well, in the words of one very leading evolutionary thinker of some years ago, whom I have quoted time and time again, who actually bears the name of one of the most famous of all, whose experiments led toward the belief of evolution and its wide acceptance by the intellectual fraternities of much of the world, its acceptance in textbooks and in college classes, almost universally around the country. Same with Huxley, you might remember that. Well, a member of that family also admitted a little later on in a statement widely publicized by himself that we wanted to find words to that effect, that there was no God, that they actually have admitted that there was a motive involved, that it interfered with a person's, and even the word sexual activities or sexual habits was used in one case in a very famous quotation in a college-level textbook on the subject of the motivation for evolution. Now, evolution tries to explain creation without a creator. It tries to explain the existence of law without a lawgiver. It tries to explain the existence of life without pre-existing life and without a life giver. It tries to explain orderliness from randomness. It tries to explain the systems which act, which preserve, which protect, such as the various laws and theories of thermodynamics and the conservation of energy, meaning the sustaining forces that keep the world out here turning, that keep life going, the support systems that act just like a gigantic, interdependent, very technical machine on which we live, which is utterly dependable on this earth. They try to explain the sustaining of those systems without a sustainer. In short, they try to explain that there is no God, which is worthy of worship. They almost, you might say, are like the ancient pagans in one way, because then all there is left to worship is our own selves, as well as our environment. So many times people end up doing precisely that. They worship themselves or other men. They worship various governmental systems. They worship the beauty and the symmetry in our environment. Many people think that there are, in a sense, gods or deities in nature. Now, maybe there are just people who kind of make a god out of nature. You can have Mother Nature. Why Mother instead of Father, I don't know. But they like to ascribe to nature, a living, breathing kind of a system here, which is totally and remarkably interwoven and dependent upon itself. The story of how a forest gradually grows and the trees die and become soil, and then the new trees and the plants feed upon the decaying vegetation of last year. Well, this is textbook stuff for kids in the early experience of this process of education as we learn about our environment and the beautiful and fabulous flora and fauna that inhabit this narrow biosphere along with us. And we begin to learn a little later on that most people think it all just happened, that it just gradually developed. It took billions of years, but here we are. Most textbooks don't give the reader a choice. You don't have on one side of the page the possibility that maybe there is a God and the story of the Bible and what the Bible says about creation. You don't have in most textbooks in most colleges explanations about how the Bible fully corroborates, upholds, and definitely gives credence to those claims of science which are known science, measurable science, absolutes in science, the physical sciences, but not the speculations and the theories of some scientists. There's a difference. The Bible does, in every respect, allow for there to have been a world here for 4.5 billion years. The Bible would allow for a gigantic destruction in the entirety of the universe. As a matter of fact, there's quite an interesting story on how that did happen. If you want to sometime read the 14th chapter of Isaiah and the 28th chapter of Ezekiel, when you will read about an absolute gigantic battle in outer space, so to speak. Where did the moon get its pockmarks? Where did those horrible, huge pockmarks come from on the face of Mars? Well, you all know that those were gigantic astral bodies, sometimes up to 100 miles across, that smashed into the surface of those planets. But yet, during our experience, during our lifespan, during the generations who have gazed at the surface of the moon, there have been no new craters appearing. Maybe tiny microscopic ones, maybe little tiny ones as meteoritic showers might pass through the area and tiny meteorites might impact the surface of the moon. But those great huge ones of ancient yesteryear, no more. No, they're not being formed anew now. So what you have in outer space is basically floating wreckage. If you were to be floating across the ocean like Ra-2 or Kon-Tiki or something, and you came across several square miles of all types of debris, and here you saw the fore end of a lifeboat, and over there was a raft that was only partially inflated, and over here was a torn life jacket, and somewhere else was an overturned boat, and there were empty floating cans and all types of things, cushions and so on, you would immediately begin to assume you had come across the scene of the explosion, the sinking, the wrecking, or somehow anyway, the destruction of a ship. And you would be seeing wreckage, which proved it. Now, when you look out into outer space, you're looking at wreckage. You don't see beauty in the sense of life, the greenness, the uniqueness that is on our Earth, on these other planets. But you see a bleak, hostile, empty, barren wasteland of sharp, jagged ridges, of rills, of upthrusts, of various flows appearing to be lava, which they haven't really proved yet, and they don't know. You know, they originally thought that when they landed on the moon, there might be moon dust, which could be up to hundreds of feet thick. They didn't really know. They thought that maybe the men could disappear in a gigantic cloud of dust, and so, of course, the unmanned landings tended to prove that that was not so. And they had to experiment to determine that before they were willing to risk human life to try to get to the surface of the moon, because they didn't really know what was the texture of that surface. Now they do, and they found that the substance of those rocks is just about exactly like that of the Earth, so they determined that the moon is kind of an offshoot of the Earth, or at least that they both had their birth at the same time. And in that, they are right. And so did the rest of this solar system of ours, and for that matter, the universe. But now our minds balk at that. Our minds don't balk at the claims of science that say, quote, in the beginning was a giant atom, and that giant atom exploded, and that giant atom became all that we see out in our solar system and the universe today.
All these stars. Now, that doesn't boggle anybody's mind, because that's under the aegis and the auspices of science. But if someone comes along and says, the Bible says, in the beginning, God created, that really boggles the human mind. Why? Well, because most people don't realize that human nature is animosity and enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be, according to what the Bible says. In Romans 8 and verse 7, that the carnal mind is not subject to the laws of God, and neither indeed can be. People don't want God interfering in their daily lives. They don't want God's laws directing and regulating how they live and how they think and the kind of a person they are. They don't want God's laws regulating their marriage and their relationships with other people in the business world. They don't want God interfering in their private politics, in their personal habits, in their choices and appetites. They don't want consciousness of God, of responsibility toward God, of the possibility of punishment if they break God's laws to enter their mind. They would like to think we are in a universe where there is no great higher power who is going to call us into an accounting for those things done during our physical life. And so it's a natural for evolution. Evolution has fertile soil in which to grow, because people would naturally want to believe in evolution simply because of our human nature and its makeup, which the Bible defines as enmity against God. So evolution has fertile soil in which to grow. And I'm going to sit back and watch the reports and see what I just predicted come true, as we will see all the articles and the speculation about these various experiments being carried out, if it's successful. There will be a lot of ifs and perhapses and maybes. Scientists speculate might be life. Apparently there's some kind of a photosynthesis that has occurred. They will speculate that as we release various gases, that something took place that might have changed those compounds, and therefore there might have been something there working on it. There will be all kinds of wonderment and speculation about the possibility of life. If you want to know whether or not God does exist, you can prove it. You can write for a book that we have on the subject about, does God exist? Well, we're actually working on a brand new one that's going to be out here, and we'll try to be working along on that. So in a few months, we'll have a really terrific book in people's hands, which will be one of the greatest efforts we've ever done, I hope, on the subject of, does God exist? But in the meantime, why don't you write for this book on how to understand prophecy, and to know why Bible prophecies represent such a major portion of the Bible, and what they mean for our day, for the time in which we live. The booklet, How to Understand Prophecy, and request the current number of the Plain Truth magazine, a magazine of understanding that gets behind the meaning of today's world news. You will see articles about the upcoming elections and America's position in the world, articles on ecology, on conservation, on the family, Christian living, articles about world geopolitics and the struggle between the big powers, the emerging new nations, the supergiants of Europe and of Japan, articles about the third world and drought and famine that is now beginning to grip even the Western world, the lack of productivity of American and Canadian farms, the terrible drought in Britain, in Europe, and in California, in many parts of the Western states of the United States. These and other issues being covered in the Plain Truth magazine. You can have yours if you will dial a toll-free number. The operators are waiting right now to take your call. It's 800-423-4444. That's 800, that's the toll-free number, 423-4444. For all of you in Alaska, California, or Hawaii, you can dial area code 213, and the number is 577-5225. That's area 213, the number is 577-5225. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, in Pasadena, California. That's the only address you need for this booklet on how to understand prophecy, and also the current number of the Plain Truth magazine. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.